Today on Straight Talk Africa, some reflections on the significance of the concept or idea of Pan-Africanism. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are discussing the significance of Pan-Africanism. Pan-Africanists believe that solidarity among people of African descent will enable the continent to fulfill its potential to independently provide for all of its people historically. The Pan-African movement takes shape in the form of a political cultural movement. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more.
The Scramble for Africa conference, chaired by German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, ended with almost all of the African continent being divided between a small group of European countries, known as the Partition of Africa in Berlin in 1884. Only Liberia and Ethiopia were not colonized. As a consequence of colonialism and imperialism, the majority of African nations lost their sovereignty and control of their natural resources. The Pan-African movement was born as a result of colonialism, initiated by blacks whose ancestors came from Africa. There are many well-known Pan-Africanists such as Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, Marcus Garvey, George Padmore, Henry Sylvester Williams, and Paul Robinson. Other notable Pan-African legends are Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, Dr. Nnamdi Azikiwe, Jomo Kenyatta, Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda, and Leopold Seda Senghor, to name a few. This generation of leaders were more outspoken about fighting for the rights of Africans. While some became Pan-Africanists merely out of curiosity and sentiments of black pride, the majority of the leaders fought for the independence of new African nations. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, an African-American civil rights leader, founded the U.S. Best National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. He moved to Accra in 1961 and lived there until his death in August of 1963. Today, he is still considered a symbol of Pan-Africanism.
He was one of the founders of our organization, and just to come and see the work that he did, him and his wife did when they came to Ghana, was just monumental for me. It was emotional, but just to see it in person was life-changing.
Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, Prime Minister of Ghana, the first black African country to regain political independence, graduated from Lincoln University in Pennsylvania. Dr. Nnamdi Azikiwe, who became Nigeria's first president in 1963, was a classmate of famed American poet Langston Hughes and former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda, Malawi's first president, graduated from Meharry Medical School in Nashville, Tennessee. Jomo Kenyatta was a Kenyan anti-colonial activist and politician who fought against British rule. The Pan-African movement also played a significant role in 1960, when 17 sub-Saharan African countries became independent from their colonial masters, 14 of them from France. Pan-Africanism was highlighted in 2019, as Ghana dubbed 2019 the year of return. The country welcomed over 1 million Africans in the diaspora to visit the nation and discover their African roots.
We are all part of the black race. We are all Africans, right? Whether you're an African in America, whether you're an African in Brazil, whether you're African in the Caribbean, if you have a high level of melanin in your skin, you are from Africa.
The Year of Return campaign was launched by Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo in Washington, D.C. in September of 2018. So far, high-profile visitors, including several African-American celebrities, members of the U.S. Congress, and other notable personalities have visited Ghana. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining us today are three distinguished guests: Louise Uwachu, host and popular and producer of You and I, a television talk show broadcast in Vancouver, Canada. Michael Brown, lobbyist and politician, and in Frankfurt, Kentucky. We are joined via telephone link up by educator and Pan-African activist Raphael Jackson. I have to say, ladies and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, brother.
You're most welcome.
Asante sana, ndugu.
It's very nice to see you, of course, in studio for the first time, Louise, because the last time you joined us via telephone link up from Vancouver.
Absolutely.
And for you, Michael, I remember several years ago having a sort of an exchange of social amenities with you somewhere downtown in Washington, D.C., Adams Morgan, perhaps.
You have an excellent memory. Excellent.
And in fact, you promised to one of those days to be on the show.
Well, here we are.
You're most welcome. It's really a pleasure to, you know, to have the opportunity and to host you for the first time, and especially talking about this most important topic, really, Pan-Africanism.
Yes.
First of all, let me ask you, Louise, very, very briefly,
yes,
what does Pan-Africanism mean to you?
Yes. Oh, I love it. Pan-Africanism is anything that would be in the best interest of African people, black people, locally and globally. Because Africans need to realize that we're not just local to anywhere, we're actually a global force. And we've been everywhere on the globe. And the thing that is so beautiful about Africans and about African people and their presence over the globe is the fact that everywhere we went, we brought civilization, we brought peace and prosperity. That is the legacy of Africa around the globe. So Pan-Africanism for me is anything that would advance the best interest and look out for Africans no matter where they are. We need to look at the local issues and the global issues as well and connect them, because when we separate, sometimes we separate the local issues and the global issues and things go wrong. But if we can look at it globally and locally, it will be successful.
Very interesting. What about you, Michael?
Pride. I think it has to do with pride. And as times change, things change. I think for a long time, African Americans thought what pride meant was understanding our history with the motherland and the continent to general tourism. And then it started to transition to business. How do we make sure that economics plays a role also in understanding what pride is all about? And Pan-Africanism. And over the time, I think African-American business folks have gotten a little frustrated with what's happening, with the lack of being able to do business in the motherland and the frustration with that. Again, clearly you can go over whenever you like and get to know your history of a people, be a nice tourist, put your money in the coffers of those wonderful countries, but also people want to do business. So that pride definition has to also change to making sure that the doors are swinging open both ways. If you're an African business person, you should be able to do business in America. If you're an African American business person, you should be able to do business in Africa.
You know, Michael, talking about pride reminds me about a former megastar, the late James Brown, who basically had this song about I am black and beautiful.
Yes.
I wish we had that sort of music here. What about you, Ndugu Raphael? What does Pan-Africanism mean to you? I gather that at one time you were preparing in Brooklyn, New York to go and resettle in a country called Tanzania.
Yes. Yes, sir. That was with G2 Weusi, the East Cultural Center, and Baba Mfariji, who was teaching us Swahili. And this was back in the 60s. And our goal was to, you know, repatriate. Now, the some of us got to go, some of us didn't. But Pan-Africanism means to me, it's mainly on a personal and humanistic level. For example, if I don't go to your house and eat your food, if I go to your house and don't understand your music, if I don't understand your culture, then Pan-Africanism is a book, it's a theory. But see, when I can come and eat fufu and ngali and pepper soup and listen to and listen to the music, that's what pulls the people together. I always gave you the story of Mary Makeba in Pata Pata.
Yes.
And when we first heard it, it was we went crazy. The next thing came with Babatunji, Olatunji, Drums of Passion. So many of my friends went and danced with them. Rizaki Shangi. These are people that made it happen on the ground. And see, once you make contacts, doing business is much easier. Because, you know, in any place doing business, and particularly in Africa, we're talking about that, there are a lot of roadblocks. But you know and I know, it's people that open the doors. You know, if your visa isn't right and you know somebody who's a relative of somebody, it's going to be that much easier.
Very interesting.
So, so when you make those contacts, here, like with Azikwe and Paul Robeson, a lot of these early Pan-Africanists were on the ground with the people. Were on the ground, not staying in the five-star hotels, which is nice, but if you don't have that contact with the people, everything's going to be very difficult. Even here, because there's not that much difference between the Caribbean, the United States, and Africa. You've got to know people. And once you know people and you eat their food, listen to their music, besides wearing their clothes and speak a little of their language, doors fly open. Doors fly open.
What about Rafael's talk about food? He talks about pepper soup, of course. It's very delicious. I've had occasion to taste it.
Yeah.
He talks about ugali and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
What about nyama choma?
Absolutely. You know, they say that we are what we eat.
Yes.
So Africans have had a special diet since ancient times. Mm. And this is also what makes them strong. Everybody today is going healthy, they're going organic, but it's like they're actually returning to the African diet. The African diet was vegetarian. They would eat meat occasionally, special occasions. That's when they're gonna have nyama choma. That's when they're gonna have the cow, you know, special occasions. But they're not eating meat every day, and they're not, their diet is vegetables, mainly. You know, meat is for special occasions. Mm. And you see people today, a lot of people are going vegetarian, but I'm thinking it's like, oh, they're coming back to the African way of life.
Mm. Very interesting. What about you, Michael?
As I mentioned to you before we started broadcasting, I had a favorite restaurant I used to go to in Accra called the Country Kitchen.
Yes, you talked about that.
And being of a Western tongue, I did want to experiment a little bit, but they had this fish dish that was excellent, incredible vegetables, but the service was great, people were great, food was great. Now, I'll tell you a quick story. So I was in Zimbabwe on one of the trade missions during the Clinton days.
Right. Was that when your dad, the great Ron Brown, was Secretary of Commerce?
Yes, he had passed on by then.
Yeah, well,
Well, thank you for mentioning my dad. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
He had passed on by then. But I was sitting next to the First Lady of Zimbabwe.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought over crickets.
Mm-hmm.
And they were on the menu.
Was that Sally Mugabe?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, it must have been Sally, not Grace, yeah.
And so I saw it on the menu, but I didn't know what that meant. I said, hey, I'm learning. Part of, you know, being an African-American, you want to learn about your previous culture. And So the gentleman came over, the server came over with two pots of crickets. Mm. One was raw and one was roasted. Of course, I picked a roasted.
Oh, okay.
Because they were moving around in the raw ones.
Right.
And so I said, no, thank you. And Miss Mugabe hit me under the table and said, no, Mr. Brown, you need to take one. So I had my beer in one hand. Uh-huh. I grabbed a roasted cricket in the other, chewed on it, and you know, it was interesting.
Yeah.
But I took a quick gulp of my beer. And I didn't think anyone would believe me. So I took the menu, put it in my pocket, and brought it home to show people.
Really?
And that's how you, educate, right? That's how we have to educate.
Yeah.
Very interesting. What about, you know, here in Washington, D.C., there was a time when there was a great Nyama Choma, you know, hangout called the Kilimanjaro. You remember Kilimanjaro?
Of course,
in Adams Morgan?
Of course. Mm-hmm. Gentrification has changed things, even in Washington, well, especially Washington.
Yeah.
But now you can still find good African restaurants off of U Street.
Right, yes. Especially Ethiopian.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Parts of Northern Virginia, you can find some places.
Yes.
But they're not like they used to be.
You can go to Maryland and find some Kenyan restaurants.
And a lot of Caribbean restaurants.
Swahili Village.
Absolutely.
You name it.
Well, there used to be a lot of Jamaican restaurants in
town. That's right.
We don't have as many anymore as we used to. So you got to go find it. If you want it, you can find it.
So why is that so?
I think, well, as I mentioned, I think that word gentrification has
gentrification.
A lot to do with it. And I think the new population, the new demographic prefers a different type of restaurant in their neighborhoods. And that's too bad. It's unfortunate that you can't do both. Why can't you have your cute little bar grill that you want, but also have a nice little Ghanaian restaurant? Why not?
Very interesting. Now, Ndugu Rafael, you mentioned some pillars of Pan-Africanism earlier. You mentioned the names like George Padmore.
Yes.
You mentioned like Dr. Du Bois.
Yes.
You could mention Sylvester Williams.
Sylvester Williams, yes.
You could mention people like Paul Robeson, for example.
Yes.
You could mention Marcus Garvey.
Yes.
Father Divine.
Father Divine, yeah.
You could talk about the great Osagyefo.
Yes.
Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. You could talk about people like Malawian founding president, Dr. Hastings Kamuzu Banda. You could talk about a man whose name you fell in love with, who used to be referred to when I was very, very young, growing up in Kabale, southwestern Uganda, as Zeke of Africa.
Zeke.
Nandi Azikwe.
Yeah.
You could talk about all those types of figures, and they really made great contributions towards what we know as Pan-Africanism.
Yes.
What happened?
I think that, everything's evolving. And we also have to throw in Paul Cuffey, who took ships to West Africa. And also, when you mentioned, there's another, his name is Daddy Grace.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing, Daddy Grace was a preacher here in the United States, but he's from Cabo Verde. He's from Cape Verde.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people don't, you know that. I think what happens is that when we were allowed to vote in certain places and the brothers on the continent got their independence, we kind of withdrew within ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And we just start looking at, what's in it for me? And so that's, but for me, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always an African community in Brooklyn, New York.
Mm-hmm.
There were Caribbean people, African people, Afro-Latinos. So that core group held. But the younger people, you know, since access came to them, to go to school. Access came to the African to go, you know, come to England, to Britain, and the Caribbean, and United Kingdom. And I guess we kind of got selfish. I think we kind of got selfish. And,
was Brooklyn more of a center of Pan-Africanism than, say, Harlem in Upper Manhattan?
Oh, yes. Most people from Harlem would dispute that. But we had an organization that's called the East.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the International African Festival that's given every year. We've been doing it 50 years. We had people like Fela come, Sunny Ade.
Fela Anakuli Pokuti?
Yes.
The Nigerian megastar?
Yes.
Have you been to
in Brooklyn?
Have you been to his shrine in Lagos?
Yes, I was at his shrine. I went into his dressing room. And you know that there's a statue of him where he's got his fist out and give it dap. It has been broken because so many people have given it. They've given it so much dap. But, I was on the ground. I was on the ground there. And a lot of Nigerians were like, wow, you went there? I said, yeah. They weren't you afraid? I said, why should I be afraid? This is Brooklyn. This is Salvador Bahia. These are my people, so I'm not afraid. Why should I be afraid of my own people, you know?
Very, very interesting. When you study some of these pillars of Pan-Africanism, you really become remarkably impressed.
Yes.
By the energy that they had.
Oh, yeah.
The commitment towards freedom,
yes,
of all of us, really.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there's no question, there's no doubt in my mind, and a lot of people who have done their homework, that perhaps without those types of pillars,
yes,
most of Africa would still be under European rule.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm.
Yes. Yes.
How did they do it?
Mm.
These are the same people also eventually.
Yes.
Who also helped to liberate our black brothers and sisters here through the civil rights movement.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, Africa is alive, and Africans are alive around the planet. We are the best survivors on this planet. We have been attacked from all sides of the continent, the north, the south, the east, and the west. It's actually amazing that we are still alive. And we are still aiming for freedom. We are the original people on this planet.
From Olduvai Gorge.
Exactly. And everybody has tried to exterminate Africans on this continent of America, in Asia. I was actually going to talk about China. There used to be an African civilization in Asia. There used to be an African civilization in China, in Japan. That African civilization was destroyed by China. Ancient Japan was African. The legacy of this civilization is that they brought civilization, they brought prosperity through African knowledge. It would actually benefit the entire world to have an African leadership. Because whenever we have had an African leadership anywhere, that African leadership has accomplished amazing things. We built the pyramids. We built an ancient civilization that inspired the European civilization. The great philosophers and the great people of Europe, the Romans and the Greeks, they came to study in Africa. In South America, the Olmecs, the civilization that was here, we were in America before Christopher Columbus and before the Vikings.
So it's very interesting.
The whole world would benefit if they had an African leadership, African ideas, African ideals, because when we are in leadership, we do not discriminate. We are a meritocracy. We go with who deserves the position, who is serving the people, who is serving humanity and divinity. And one of the things that is so powerful about Africa is the African spirituality. This is why you see that we have been invaded by religions, Islam and Christianity, to destroy the African spirit, because the original spirit connects each and every African to the divine. The African spirituality thinks and believes and knows that divinity exists in each of us. We just have to rise our divinity. We just have to cultivate it and rise into our divinity. And every time that there has been an African leadership around the world, the whole society benefited, the entire world benefited. We see the world together colliding and going to war. This would not happen if they let us rule the world.
Very, very interesting, Michael, listening to, obviously, to what you hear. She talks about how the African people were the first on this planet Earth. And in fact, there is research to support that statement, Boot. And the man or the family that, in fact, carried out that work was not an African family. It was a European family, and it's called the Rikers.
Yeah.
The Rikers found that evidence in Old Vai Gorge,
yes,
which happens to be in East Africa. Isn't that interesting?
Incredible. But it's as incredible as anything else when we have to do a better job telling our own story historically.
Exactly.
And when other people tell it, it gets either, but depending what term you want to use, whitewashed, or I knew I've used this term quite a bit, gentrified, because even the history books are getting gentrified.
Mm.
Yeah.
You look in for, you know, slavery, for example.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, a couple pages in a history book, like, well, it, you know, lasted a couple years, it wasn't
yes,
a big deal.
Yes.
When, in fact, it lasted maybe a couple centuries, and it was a big deal. But it's almost like, unless we tell the story, I remember growing up, we had Encyclopedia Britannica. Mm-hmm. That was our, we didn't have the internet. You mm-hmm. couldn't Google, yeah. if you were doing a term paper, you couldn't Google something. You had to go into Encyclopedia Britannica, or go to the library mm-hmm. and get what you need. And you got so much information. Today's world is so fast and so quick that, oh, I need to do a book report on slavery. There are a couple pages. And like, oh, okay, it wasn't a big deal. And yeah, it seems to be similar to other atrocities that have gone on in the world. So if we don't tell our story, that's why the African Union is so important, that's based here in Washington, is making sure that there's always that voice and that connection. Like the European Union gets treated like the European Union gets treated. Why doesn't the African Union get treated the same way?
Hmm.
It is very frustrating. I know Raphael mentioned it. I've mentioned it. I know Luis mentioned about business and the corridors of business. It is extremely frustrating when you watch folks say, hey, you know what, your investment dollars are safer in Eastern Europe rather than in Africa. Mm. That makes absolutely no sense.
Mm-hmm.
War-torn Eastern Europe and Russia's right next door, why would that be a better place for your investment dollar than Africa or other places of color around the world? So we have a lot of work to do. We need to tell our own history. That would help.
It's very interesting. Well, time happens not to be, of course, our best ally. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you. Appreciate all of the audience feedback, and Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. You can watch our show there and leave a comment. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Historically black colleges and universities in the United States are expanding in the continent and creating new educational opportunities for young Africans. HBCUs in the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
And today we are talking about the concept or idea of Pan-Africanism. Our guests are Louise Uwachu, host and producer of the You and I television talk show in Vancouver, Canada, Michael Brown, formerly of the Democratic National Committee, and from Kentucky, we are joined by educator and activist Raphael Jackson. Again, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you again for having us.
You're most welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You're most welcome, Ndugu Raphael. Ndugu Raphael, you are a historian. Well, at least you come from that background. You heard, of course, Michael says something very interesting about history, that we need to begin to write our own history.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I recall that at one time, reading about a former great British Prime Minister, Sir Winston Churchill, he was being asked how he thought that history would treat him, and he said he doesn't really have to worry about that, luckily, because he's actually going to write it himself, and it so happens that he used to be a very good writer. Yes. And a former U.S. President, Richard Nixon, who had to resign from the White House because of Watergate, he actually responded to the same question, that if you want history to be favorable to you, either you have to write it yourself or commission someone to do it on your behalf.
Yeah.
I didn't really know that until I happened to be in graduate school at UCLA studying a course called historiography.
Yeah.
Different interpretations of history. That is when I realized that we really have to do exactly what was stated by Michael. What about you?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, you know, when you mentioned Winston Churchill, I remember being in the library at Howard and seeing, I think he wrote a history of the British or the English people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, several volumes. And, you know, you just don't think of him as an author. And but we have to write our own history. I was privileged to study with Dr. Yosef Ben-Yakinen.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. John Henry Clark, and Ivan Van Sertima. And
yes. Great
they pushed.
Mm-hmm.
They pushed. You have to study. You have to study languages. And I was on the internet, and there's this sister from Ghana who's doing this 54-volume work on Africa. I've got to get in contact with her and see what's, you know, and see how she's doing. But see, we have the man and woman power to do it. We have great minds. I mean, the sister, when she was talking and the brother was talking, they're giving me chills.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying, whoa, this is good. And I want to just throw in, I think it's the Roman Emperor Pliny, mm-hmm. or the writer Pliny, said something new always comes out of Africa. And there's an Arab saying that he who has drank from the waters of Africa will always return. And one of the things that the sister was talking about, the culture in Japan, I was in Japan. I was looking for the, I was there a month. We were doing some research and we were looking for the Ainu people up in the north in Hokkaido. And one of the things that struck me was that I asked a translator about, do they say anything about us that you wouldn't translate? And he said, no, they talk about your hair and your height. I'm a short guy. I'm 6'5".
Mm-hmm.
And I had my afro. And they said, how do you perm your hair? Look how he perms his hair. And I said, no, this is not a perm. And I said, touch it. And he touched it. And he went into ecstasy. I was in the museum there, and some kids were walking by, and they stopped and saw me. And I said, hi, and they said, hi. And I said, they gave me fist bumps, right, you know. And I said, do you want to touch my hair? And when they touched my hair, they fell out in ecstasy. And I asked the guy, what's it about that? And they said, they're fascinated with the natural curl.
Yes. Very interesting.
They're fascinated by it. They have soul bars there. You know, like where they have Philly soul bars and the music, Bob Marley, Fela. They listen to all of that. They got a reggae queen there called Pusheen.
Mm.
You look like, whoa. You go to the club, you'd swear you're in Jamaica.
Very interesting. Of course, so, you have Miriam Makeba with your Pata Pata, and you might add Malaika.
Oh, my God.
Nakupenda Malaika.
Oh, one
I love
last,
you, Malaika.
Mm-hmm. One last antidote. If you remember Mano Dibango, Soul Makossa.
Yes, the man from the Cameroon.
Yeah, it hit the clubs in New York, but they wouldn't play it on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And years later, we talked to the guy, and the guy said, well, they didn't want to play it on the radio because they thought that he was giving instructions to black people to overthrow the system in his language.
Very interesting.
And I laughed as I said, you know, they weren't that far off because Soul Makossa opened up the Caribbean, opened up North America to what we kind of call Afrobeat.
He used to be based in Paris and later Brussels, yeah.
Yeah,
very interesting. I used to really dance, his jig in Kampala so many years ago. Now, let me ask you a question, Louise, that is apparently trending. As we talk, people are watching, people are tweeting, people are doing all sorts of things, but they are wondering really about the state or the status of Pan-Africanism.
Yes.
Is it still a reality or a myth, or are we in fact looking at Pan-Africanism as having perhaps the future behind it, or is it still the real thing?
Yes,
that we can actually do it, that can actually help liberate us.
Absolutely. Africa is alive. Africans are alive. Pan-Africanism is not going to die, because our unity is the foundation. Our unity is cultural unity is a reality between Africans, whether it's within the languages or within the culture. We may have many nations, as Sheikh Anta Diop used to say, but we have one culture. It is Pan-Africanism when Black America goes back to Africa, goes back to Ghana, that's the year of return. That is Pan-Africanism.
Very interesting.
It's so alive. And this is just the beginning. We need to remember that slavery was an economic necessity for Europeans. Once you take over a continent, they needed experts, experienced people, highly qualified people to come and work and build them a civilization. And Africans had an experience in building a successful civilization. They were so qualified. They were actually overqualified. The Europeans could not afford their labor. And you cannot get Africans out of Africa when they're doing so well. So what do? You create war, conflict, and chaos, and you kidnap Africans out of Africa so you can have them come and help you build your own country. Mm-hmm. So it was an economic necessity. Black America has done amazing things in America. But they're coming back to Africa.
Mm.
And the African people, Black America and everybody in the world, or Africans in Europe, this is actually the international community that Africa needs. We have had this other kind of international community coming into Africa, but they haven't done well. They haven't looked out for the best interest of Africa. But Africans themselves, like African Americans, if they become our international community that comes back to Africa, they'll be coming back home, they'll bring positive things, and they will be greeted, they will be welcomed back home in love. And for once, they'll be within a continent, within a culture and a society that actually appreciates them and welcomes back home as family. So Pan-Africanism is alive. We are the original people on this planet, and we will be the last people on this planet.
Very interesting. What about you, Michael? Until really recently, the year of return, which is sponsored by the Republic of Ghana and its president, Nana Akufo-Addo. The only other time, frankly, I had heard about Pan-Africanism being a bit active was in Uganda in the 1990s, under Yoweri Museveni, who had appointed a brother of mine, Nigerian, the late Dr. Tajuddin Abdulrahim, a former Rhodes Scholar at Oxford. Unfortunately, he died in a motor accident in Nairobi many years ago. The only thing now I hear is about the year of return. What is the year of return from your point of view?
Well, as anything else, marketing has a lot to do with how it's defined. What does it mean to our brothers and sisters here in the United States, African Americans? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Does it mean, and keep in mind, when I mentioned marketing, Senegal has done a wonderful job with the Door of No Return, or the mm-hmm. Window of No Return, whichever you Gori. Call it, and Gori. The mm-hmm. Benin has done a pretty good job with their showing their piers, their beaches, and what happened in that part of West mm-hmm. Africa. Mm-hmm. But there's nothing wrong with marketing as long as folks understand the importance of the result of that marketing. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you need to go back. Why not? I mean, obviously, affordability has a lot to do with how people are able to travel. Because mm-hmm. There are probably millions of people that would love to go to visit mm-hmm. the continent, mm-hmm. but just don't have the ability or wherewithal mm-hmm. To do it. Mm-hmm. So whether it's different foundations that have to now play a bigger role in making it, I'm glad HBCUs are playing a much larger role on the continent. Mm-hmm. But the interest is also important relative to what we were talking about earlier. Social media is such a big part of how people learn. For example, when I was younger, without dating myself.
You're still so young.
You still look very young to me, Michael.
That's what my children will tell you.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But thank you very much. Is when we were younger and Roots was on television, the nation was riveted every single night. You didn't have a choice. You weren't watching Monday Night Football. You weren't watching anything but Roots.
Alex Haley.
And you learn. I mean, obviously, America learned. In today's world, folks are more interested in binging their favorite reality show than how about binging Roots? How about doing that? And that is, and there's so many other movies. I don't mean to make it. And obviously, Alex Haley did a wonderful job.
You know, he was quite. He was a remarkable guy because, among other things, he once said, "Find something good in somebody and praise it." Very interesting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So. Very interesting. But let's face it. We go back to March 6, 1957, when the first country that is in Black Africa regains its political independence from the British. And at the helm is Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. This man basically challenges the Ghanaians that the independence of Ghana would be meaningless unless it is linked to the total liberation of Africa. And he did not simply talk the talk, by the way. He He actually walked the talk by making sure that he provided the necessary tools to help his brothers and sisters liberate themselves.
Yeah.
Is there any simple country that you can look at now on the continent or on this globe now? Because we even have a country like Haiti, which yeah. is made up of black people and got independence in 1804. Is there a country of people who look like you and me which can make the statement, for example, that the democracy of our country is not, it will not be justified unless it is linked with the democratization of the rest of Africa, or Africans,
brother,
for that matter?
Let me chime in on that. You mentioned Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
Dessalines stated the same thing that Krumah stated. Our independence means nothing. And when the black world is still enslaved, 1804,
mm-hmm.
they sent troops to Jamaica. They sent troops to Puerto Rico. They helped liberate South America with Simón Bolívar.
Mm-hmm.
When Simón Bolívar was fighting the Spanish, he asked Haitians, and they said, look, you got to free your slaves. And he did. And that's why today, Haitians are revered in those countries, Colombia, Peru, and places like that. Also, when the Congo got its independence, they called Haitians, again, as the doctors and the teachers.
Correct.
To come over there to help. Cuba, when the South Africans invaded Namibia and the Cubans came, Operation Colada. Colada was an African slave, a woman enslaved in Cuba. And they pushed the South Africans back. See, it's there.
Out of Angola.
Yeah, out yes. of Angola.
Hmm.
That spirit is there. But we've been put to sleep. And I'll give you another example. You mentioned Michael mentioned roots.
Yes.
We've got an explosion going on. We may not be that. If you get your hair braided, you'll be subjected to the Nollywood movies. The Nollywood movies are all over South America, all over the black world in the Caribbean.
What about the black exploitation genre? How can it be made in such a way that it can motivate and inspire the African people?
Well, here's my... What Tyler Perry did, took a VHS camera
mm-hmm.
and videotaped his plays. What Oscar Micheaux did back in the 20s and 30s, you did your own movies. The one of the great movies, The Hard As They Come, they told him to burn it.
Really?
They told him to burn it because no one's going to watch it. It's a cult classic. They call it a cult classic. See, when you, and it's and Melvin Van Peebles, when he did Sweetback, whatever you think of it, he shot it, he wrote it, he scripted it, he developed it, he edited it, and got an unknown band called Earth, Wind, and Fire to do the music.
Very interesting, very interesting.
So you can do, like, I was in Nigeria. Some of those Nollywood movies only cost
$10,000.
And look how they proliferate Africa.
Nollywood, both movies and music, as a matter of fact.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Oh, yes. So we can do it. So we can do it. We don't have to look for big budget stuff. As the sister said, the world's going to follow us.
Well,
they're going to follow what we do.
I think we should go now beyond Cannes and make sure that we actually do it.
Yeah.
Because our people need it, really.
Yeah.
We are not even arguably.
Yeah.
We happen to come from a part of the world which probably houses the most significant wealth.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
we happen to be in a position where we have been helping other countries to become superpowers.
Yes.
But not our own people.
Yes.
Yes.
We have Africa that is so rich, and yet African people are so poor.
Yeah.
They don't even have a guarantee of 3 meals a day.
Yeah.
And part of the reason, frankly, is that there are observers who think about the presence of leadership deficit.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Leadership deficit. How do we correct this?
Absolutely.
So that our own people can be the beneficiaries of their God-given wealth.
Absolutely.
How can we bring about social, economic, political justice?
Absolutely.
For all of us?
Yes.
Yeah.
Leadership. When we talk a second about leadership, ancient African leadership was always initiated. They are trained from a very young age to grow from their animality into humanity and to go above humanity and rise into your divinity.
From animality to humanity.
To humanity, to divinity.
In very simple terms, what do you really mean, at least for a very average audience?
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
You see, even in our brains, we have several parts in our brain, the animal brain, the thinking brain, the conscious brain.
What does the animal do?
It goes by instinct. It is not led by higher values, morality, and consciousness.
Is it destructive?
It is destructive. It is divisive.
Is it a thief?
This spirit of division, that is in your lower self. It just looks out for itself, and it goes for interest, it goes for the kill. But the higher self, the divinity self, is uniting, is holistic. It understands that divinity exists in each of us, and we are all connected to the Supreme.
It's a bridge builder.
Exactly. It's a unifying type of relationship with everyone. So our ancient leadership was trained to rise all the way up to divinity. And once you're there and you see your unity with all, any policy that you make will be beneficial to your people. These days, our leaders are dictators. Dictators who have been manipulated and imposed upon their population.
You say these days, are you saying that our kings, queens were not dictators?
No. They were looking out for the best interest of the people, and they always aimed for peace and prosperity for all. Today's leadership are very selfish. They look out for themselves. They give all the businesses contracts to their own families, and then the rest of the population suffers. But the ancient kings were worshipped for bringing peace and prosperity to the entire society. And they understood life beyond materialism. You understand that you are temporal on this planet. So what is the point of accumulating all this materialism? What is more important is the effect and your work on this planet and how you're going to spiritually affect people so that they can go into posterity, look with those values, looking out for prosperity for all. Today's leadership is very spiritually poor, spiritually underdeveloped, spiritually retarded. So we cannot expect anything from them because they're not trained to be leaders for all. And this is actually a strategy from the invaders and the destroyers of Africa to have weak leaders.
But what about the idea of making sure that we hold them accountable?
We can hold them accountable by always challenging them, always denouncing them, never be silent on their crimes and everything that they do, the exploitation. They need to be exposed. And once they're exposed, it can be resolved. Anything that works in the dark, they prefer if their crimes were hidden. So it's very important, no matter what is the risk, because we have ruthless dictatorships which are ruling by the power of the gun. And we need to move from that to the power of ideas and ideals. So they need to be denounced because ideas are more powerful than the guns. And this is the whole point of creating our own media. This is actually why I created my own media platform, my own talk show, because Africa does need its own media platforms, a place where we can freely discuss our own ideas and freely educate our own people. Because once the people are educated, then they can rise from their animality to humanity to divinity, and then we'll see the effects into the whole society.
Michael, do you buy into this?
Yes.
You better.
You said it wonderfully.
So how do we actually do it? Because let's face it, in the 1980s, The Dr. Du Bois says George Padmore was Sylvester William Kwame Nkrumah's of the world. They decided to move the epicenter of Pan-Africanism from Europe to the African continent.
And when you first asked the question,
yes,
when we started the show, I mentioned the word pride.
Yes.
And nothing against other, though I don't know if I consider African Americans an immigrant group by the definition, but other immigrant groups that came through Ellis Island. They, you know, those immigrant groups can go to the Ellis Island history books, find their family name. Yes, we can do the, I know there are these new companies, I don't want to say a particular name.
You can and enjoy swab the American your dream.
Yes, you can swab your cheek and find out where, we can find out where we're from.
Mm.
But that doesn't mean we know who our family is. And so if you're from another immigrant group, you can go to the Ellis Island books, find your family name. Not only do you know your name, when they came, where they're from. So their pride is different than our pride. Our pride, obviously, we were separated immediately, intentionally. The slave masters didn't want us to know who our families were. That was the whole point.
Right.
So we couldn't galvanize ourselves. Hence, what Nat Turner did was wonderful. And
I saw that in Roots.
Yes. So that is part of our challenge. And so that means we have to figure it out. When we talk about writing our own history, telling our own history, how do we overcome our young folks' attention span? And how do we get them to get out of mediocrity and how to achieve more? My wife and I were talking about this the other night. How do we get our kids,
and
not just our kids,
how
just children.
Do we promote Ubuntu, humanity, for all our people?
That's the challenge. That's the challenge. We have to take the lead. And can't be afraid for people to say no. No what? No, we can't tell our own history? Why? Because you're not going to like what it says?
Mm.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, Ndugu Rafael.
Well, I think that, you know, through every tragedy, horrific tragedy of the enslavement of our people, the benefit is I can go to Ghana and people in Ghana say, oh, you look just like one of us.
Mm-hmm.
I can go to Kenya and they say, I look like one of us. So I can bond with all of the African continent, okay? I may have been a little hindered. Let's say if I was Xhosa or Zulu or Igbo or Hausa or Bibio, I may have an affiliation, a strong affiliation to them and not my other brothers. But the advantage that we have in the West, it's really, we're related to everybody.
Time is not our best ally, Rafael.
Huh?
Time is not our best ally, and on that note, our guests today were Luis Uwachu, Michael Brown, and Rafael Jackson. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa, and please remember to keep the African hopes alive.